Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is the founder and president of Bombic Software, Mike Bombic. Mike, good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, thank you. It's great to talk to you. I've been a big fan of your product for a long time. And I want to learn a whole lot more about Carbon Copy Cloner, your major product, and all the things that kind of led up to that.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so let's just chat and have fun and tell us how things went. What were you doing in your early career, long before you started with Apple? Because you're very technical to do what you do, at least I think. You know.
Yeah, so before I started at Apple, I was doing my graduate work in Ohio at Bowling Green State University. I was actually studying aquatic ecology. And it's a pretty big transition from aquatic ecology to computer science.
Yeah, I would have thought you'd be in Florida for something like that.
Yeah, well, it was actually pretty natural. You know, I took some comp sci classes in college, always thinking that someday I would do something like modeling of ecological systems.
Simulations.
And, yeah, exactly, simulations. And when I got into my graduate work, I had a really good time doing the field research. But not a great time at trying to put together some sort of report on basically a failed experiment. But what I did find is that I really enjoyed the technical aspect of some of the stuff that I was doing. So I was studying a little fish called the round goby and its effect on zebra mussels in Lake Erie.
Wow.
And I had thousands of these little mussels to measure. And after just about a dozen of them, I thought, this is going to be really painful. So this was a long time ago, and digital cameras were pretty new. So I rigged up a system where I could take a picture of a bunch of mussels and then take the picture into Adobe Illustrator, draw lines on the picture, draw a calibration line, and then remove the JPEG. And then from that Illustrator file, I could find the coordinates for all of the lines, find that calibration line, figure out the length of each line, dump it into an Excel file, and then perform some statistics on it. And I was really stoked with having figured out all of the software development side of this. That I finally realized I was probably in the wrong field. So
you're not the first person to have this happen to you.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
This happens a lot.
What I really discovered is that I'm not the discovering type of person. Somebody who does science has to be creative, but they also have to have this desire to discover things. And what I found is I'm really more of a creator. I love creating things. And in just 5 minutes, you can sit down and write out a little script or application. And I find that incredibly gratifying. It's really neat to see a little bit of work do something almost magical on the screen.
I was talking to a previous guest who said that as soon as they discovered that they could take this machine, this computer, and they could do things to make it do things, to make things happen and get control of the computer, they were hooked.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild feeling. I also remember the day back in college where I decided that I was never going to allow a computer to defeat me. And I think that's another really important aspect of software development. You know, you spend maybe 5% of your time writing code and 95% debugging it. So you got to have this troubleshooting, problem-solving drive within you.
Patience, persistence.
Yeah, and I really enjoy that.
Did you go to work for Apple straight out of graduate school, or was this something you did before that?
Not quite. So for about a year, I did a tech support position at the university. And it's there that I discovered the need for Carbon Copy Cloner. And on the side, I developed it. It's funny because back then, people thought that you couldn't clone OS X. OS X was brand new. People saw it was Unix, and they thought, oh, there's fancy stuff here, and you just can't do it. Because back in the OS 9 days, you literally just dragged and dropped the system folder.
Right.
And that's all you had to do. And it just wasn't that easy. And, you know, a lot of people just thought you couldn't do it.
I remember going through that that transformation, that aha thing, where things weren't so simple anymore, like dragging the system folder. Yeah, things got kind of crazy, and you had to really step it up.
Yeah. So once I figured out the procedure, I schlepped an interface on it and started producing Carbon Copy Cloner.
What year was this?
This was 2002, January 18th, 2002.
So that was just about a year after macOS 10 shipped in March of 2001.
Yeah, something like that. I think it was 10.2 was the first operating system that it was officially supported on. I think that came out in December, something like that.
Was that Panther?
that's some old.
I don't want to quiz you. So long ago.
Maybe Jaguar. I can't remember.
Yeah. So you developed Carbon Copy Cloner and released it, and then did that make such a name for you that you got attention at Apple?
It did, and it was funny. You know, I got the Bombic.com website actually was a gift from my father-in-law, and I didn't really think much what I'd do with it. But when I developed CCC, I thought, you know, it would be so cool if I could work for Apple, and I decided to just stick it on my website and see if I could become a household name, at least within Apple. And, you know, surprisingly, it worked, especially in the enterprise and education markets. It was a pretty popular solution because at the time, there wasn't really a way to make copies of a whole system onto lots of other systems. And suddenly CCC comes along and, you know, people see a really easy way to do exactly that. So the solution made it a lot easier for people within the education and enterprise sales teams to sell their solution. And that got my name right to the exact place I wanted it to. So
I had a mother write me an email one time, and she said, "My son desperately wants to go to work for Apple. What can he do?" And when you think about that, you think about, you know, submitting a job to Apple. Submitting an application to apple.com/jobs. Mm-hmm. But it turns out, I think that you really help yourself if you do what you did and become sort of like make a name for yourself, become an expert in something. And fortunately, expertise that Apple needs at the time and respects the name you made for yourself and the expertise you have. And I wrote that to her. Mm-hmm. I hope it worked.
Yeah, you know, I never applied for a job at Apple. It was funny how I landed it.
Oh, you Gartenberged?
Yeah, and yeah. You know, it was great timing for me, and I ended up moving out to St. Louis, and I was doing actually field sales, working on the technical side of a sales team, and I spent 8 years putting together technical solutions for, you know, labs and video producers and audio professionals, journalists.
What year was that when you started?
That was also 2002. It was just about 4 months after I did.
I think we were contemporaries because I started in 2000.
Yeah.
Cool. So, I remember promoting your tool in the sales group that I was in.
Yeah.
So how did Apple feel about a Carbon Copy Cloner's existence and you continuing to sell it? Or how did that work? Did you have to suspend personal sales for a time, or did you have a license to keep selling it? How did that work?
Well, remember way back in the day, I wasn't really selling it. And I think that probably helped concerns from Apple. But what I did do is I filled out a pre-hire invention form. And that pretty much put it in the clear, at least in legal terms. But yeah, you know, they do tell you they don't want you doing stuff on the side. Right. They don't want you being creative outside of Apple's Cupertino campus.
Because normally what you do on the job belongs to Apple.
Yeah. So
was there any resistance to that pre-hire invention form? It was kind of like a raised eyebrows, a little resistance? No?
None whatsoever, really.
Cool.
And I don't know if that's because that kind of solution and that kind of innovation was desperately needed. Certainly from the people who hired me, you know, they were thrilled to have that kind of experience. And nobody would have dreamed of shutting that down at the time. But, you know, Apple corporate did make it very clear that, you know, they didn't want you making money on the side, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, back in the day, I didn't make a lot of money on it. you know, a lot of people used it and did not click that donate button. I found out just how significant that was when I did finally make the switch to a commercial model. But I think that's probably what kept Apple at bay. I wasn't overtly asking for money, and it was just donationware.
So then when you left Apple, did you have an idea that you were going to start this company right away? Was that on your mind?
Yeah. So, you know, while I was at Apple, I did a lot of other side projects. And I actually, sort of based on the CCC work, I developed another application called NetRestore, which was used for mass deployment of OS X systems in enterprise and education environments. And CCC kind of took a backseat for a while. I maintained it, but I didn't put quite as much effort into it as I did on a lot of the other projects that I had developed while at Apple.
Did you find that OS X was kind of getting away from you, that changes to OS X were kind of hard to keep up with, or did Carbon Copy Cloner survive that?
You know, not at all, actually. And in fact, my work with NetRestore took me basically on a sabbatical deeply inside of OS X. I spent a lot of really late nights digging into the boot process and really figuring out how all of that worked. In fact, with NetRestore, I created a custom network-based operating system that would boot, automatically restore, and, you know, I got in so deeply with it, I just got really, really comfortable with the boot process and you know, owning that whole process. And eventually I put that work into CCC as well.
Do you foresee a day when Apple might move to the system used in the phone, where you have a secure enclave and effaceable memory to store a key, and you have a authenticated encrypted boot sequence that's drawn from a certificate?
It's certainly a possibility.
I hope that's what's holding up the MacBooks.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. And, you know, could they make a bootable cloning solution untenable? I would certainly hope not. I think that would be very frustrating for a lot of users. I mean, it's frustrating for users of the iOS devices. I don't know that users want that sort of closed system. But
that's interesting.
You know, it's all unknown, and certainly right now, I don't see any indication that it's going in that direction. Everything, as far as the boot process is concerned, is really largely unchanged since probably about 10.4 when Apple introduced Launch D.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about some of the details of a Carbon Copy Cloner and how it works. But before we do that, I think this is a really good time to take a short break, okay?
Okay.
And I have a short ad here from Kelly. Folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. We're back with Mike Bombick. Talking
hey
about
there.
Carbon Copy Cloner. So for the benefit of those who are not quite sure how this app works, and it's legendary in my mind, but maybe it might be helpful to kind of dig into just a little bit about how this product works and some of the details of its use. Can you do that?
Yeah, sure. So the basic gist is when you create a backup with something like Time Machine, there's a, you know, it's fairly simple to set up. There's that very simple on-off button. And day-to-day, you're not really bugged by it. But when it comes to the restore process, things get a lot more challenging than people anticipate. With a time machine backup or other traditional backup methods, usually when you want to restore, you have to, let's just suppose your hard drive has failed. If you want to restore from that backup, you would have to replace that hard drive first. So run out to the store, purchase new hardware, go to the Apple store and get your hard drive replaced. And then you would have to boot into the recovery volume, restore all of your data.
Wait, there's no recovery volume on the new drive you just bought.
Or the internet recovery volume from Apple. That's correct.
Okay.
So, yeah, and that's one more logistic. You know, you have to have an internet connection, and if you don't, you know, you're going to have to go to the Apple store with your backup disk in tow. And then finally, after many hours, you finally got your data back, your Mac back, and you can get back up and working.
And you have to do a restore from Time Machine, and if it fails, you're kind of messed up.
Yeah. So with a carbon copy cloner backup, the idea is that you back up all of your stuff directly to another hard drive, and then you can use that hard drive to boot your Mac. So if your hard disk fails, you restart the system, hold down the Option key, and there's your backup disk. You select it, it boots up, and it looks just like you were booted from your original disk.
And you can carry on just like you did before the crash, and then you can figure out what you need to do with the internal drive.
Precisely.
And if the internal drive checks out, you can do a full restore, right, from the external carbon copy clone or clone.
Right. And the really nice thing about this is, you know, if you're a photographer and you're trying to get some photos done for a wedding shoot or something, you don't have to be inconvenienced by that hardware failure. You can keep working from the backup. And finally, when you're done with your deadline and you finally had some time to get your hardware replaced, while booted from the backup, you just clone right back to the new disk, reboot from the internal disk, and then you're back to your production volume.
When you clone the internal boot drive to an external drive, does it carry along with it the recovery partition bit for bit?
Yes, it does. So what CCCA actually takes two approaches to this. First off, a recovery volume isn't required on the backup disk. The recovery volume is a separate partition that you could boot to if you wanted to restore from a Time Machine backup or reinstall OS X. So on the backup disk, that recovery volume, the physical having that recovery volume present isn't required. But what we do want is a backup of the recovery volume that's associated with the source. So right off the bat, when you configure a backup task to clone your startup disk to a backup disk, CCC will archive the recovery volume that's associated with the source. That archive then gets backed up along with everything else. So at the end of the backup task, CCC will prompt you, you know, do you want to create a recovery volume on the destination? And the reason for that is I don't know when you set up your task what your intention is for that backup disk. Is it just a backup? Or are you migrating to that disk? Are you upgrading to a larger disk, for example? There's lots of ways that people use the product. Mm. So at the end of the first backup, you do get prompted to create that recovery volume. And then if you proceed, you know, you've got a recovery volume on your backup disk.
If you say no the first time, can you come back later and say, I want to do that? Is there a preference?
Yeah. So if you decided not to, which is fine, but then later on, let's say you want to enable encryption on your backup disk. You could click on the destination volume in CCC's sidebar, and then at the bottom of the window, there's a recovery HD button. You click on that, and then click a button to create the recovery HD. It's really pretty straightforward and quite simple. And ever since Lion, when Apple introduced that technology, we've been refining it further and further to make it simpler and easier for people to get that done without, you know, really getting too much of their attention.
Without getting too technical, what's that extra special sauce that makes a drive bootable? I mean, we talked about earlier in the show about how you can't just copy slash system and slash library out to a drive. It doesn't make the drive bootable.
Sure, there's a lot of things in it. You know, there's various folders that must exist. Permissions and ownership are very important to retain. Especially with the root folder, it requires specific ownership and specific mode. There's a boot.efi file that needs to be created.
These are all invisible, right?
Well, they're not invisible. They're just buried in various places within the operating system. Okay. So the volume needs to be blessed.
Blessed. Which is, that's the
which
term.
Is a funny term. And, you know, it's funny when I CCC is localized in six non-English languages. And every time I send this out to someone new, I get feedback back. What is this blessed? And I say, oh, right. Yeah, that's
well.
Does
that's it ever come back to you in another language like magic or some sort of perverted translation of blessed? Like holier than thou, just drive.
There was actually one time where somebody used some sort of religious reference, which I think we revisited that and got it straightened out. But yeah, so that's just the name of the utility. And the term actually goes back to probably macOS 7 or 8 or 9, one of those. But if you remember back in macOS 9 days, you could have a system folder without the special little icon on it, and it wasn't blessed.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Get this special procedure.
You're bringing back memories.
Yeah, like dragging and dropping it, and then it would get that icon, and it would be blessed.
Right.
So that functionality was rolled in macOS 10 into the bless utility. And basically what that does is it finds the inode number of the boot.efi file and the system library core services folder and a couple of other things. And it loads that information into the volume header. And it will also create an EFI label, a firmware label for the volume. So if your volume's named My Backup, it will create what's essentially a little image file that says My Backup. And then when you hold down the Option key on startup, the contents of that image file are presented underneath that disk icon. And then also the firmware, when it's doing its search of the device tree, it'll find an HFS formatted volume, and it'll look in the volume header, and it will find the inode number for the boot.efi file and all of the other information it needs to find the executable resources on that boot device. So that's really, if there's magic, it's that blessing right there. But then, of course, it's also imperative to have things like the kernel extension cache created. That's something that can't actually be copied from one volume to another. It makes references to specific file locations.
Oh, yeah, I see that during the carbon copy cloner process. It says updating boot caches.
Exactly. So at the end of the backup task, there's actually two sets of caches that are recreated. One is a kernel extension cache or kernel cache. The other is the dynamic linker shared cache. And that one's really important. There's some other backup utilities that skip this step. And if you were to ever compare, apples to apples, a bootable backup created by CCC versus another, open up the Activity Monitor application and compare memory usage. And you'll see that with a CCC backup, it's going to be comparable to your production volume. But with other applications, you're going to see excessive memory usage. And it actually comes with a performance penalty, too. I was just doing a comparison yesterday morning, and I had a USB 2 backup, which, granted, USB 2 is slow, but it was unbearably slow and produced by another application and then perfectly usable when it was a CCC bootable backup. So that's pretty much the gist of it, though. You know, obviously preserve all of the important system data, but then you have to mind the attributes, permissions, ownership. File flags are important, especially with El Capitan and system integrity protection. And then bless it, create those system caches, and then you're good to go. It's easy as that, just those steps.
My fantasy is complete. I've always wanted to hear you describe that.
Yeah.
Cool. Do you still have contacts at Apple that help you, or you just live life as a normal, everyday developer?
You know, it's funny. It's just like when Superman was stripped of his powers. I am just an ordinary third-party developer. I don't have any particular contacts. I do still know people within Apple, and sometimes I'm in contact with them. But in terms of day-to-day development, it's all me.
Do you mysteriously win the lottery every year to go to WWDC, or do you take potluck like everybody?
I take potluck potluck like everyone else. I actually haven't been, 3 or 4 years. But, you know, the last time I went, I was a little disappointed.
iOS mania?
Well, there's that. No, it was the fact that I think it's just going to be like this from now on. The new OS is announced on Monday afternoon or Monday morning, and you get access to it at the conference like everybody else. And you basically have like 24 hours to install it, you know, compile your application and try and figure out all of the changes that might affect you and come up with your questions that you want to take to the labs, because the folks that are in the labs that would be able to answer those questions, you can get them on Tuesday and Wednesday. Thursday, it's dicey. Mm-hmm. And Friday, everybody's gone. So I ended up having some questions on Thursday and was a little disappointed that I couldn't get them answered. It worked out in the end, but, you know, I think that nowadays they have those videos available, you know, live and almost immediately thereafter. So I'm not sure I'm missing too much. But I do look forward to going again. We actually have a new developer that we hired back in June, and it would be great for the two of us to go out there and you know, spend a week rubbing antennae with the other nerds.
Well, yeah, that's an important part of WWDC is the camaraderie, meeting old friends. Opportunities yes. arise, parties arise. Yes.
Precisely. Yes.
Well, in the short time we have left, I wanted to ask you about something else. It's something called Apple File System, which we heard about at WWDC. So after years and years and years of HFS and HFS Plus, before that was MFS, the Macintosh File System, we went through a series of augmentations, life extensions, tweaking. But HFS Plus, the hierarchical file system of the Mac, has reached the end of its rope. And yeah. Apple announced at WWDC that in 2017, we'd start to see APFS, Apple File System. Why don't you just kind of give us a brief introduction to what a file system is, and then we can talk about some of the nuances of the features of APFS.
Sure. The file system is basically a set of structures that define attributes of your files and give you a way of accessing them on the media. So it defines things like, you know, folders, files with their various attributes, and how, you know, how they're arranged on the disk.
So it knows where to go, sort of like a phone book?
Yeah, precisely. You know, you've got this big pool of storage and you've got to, you know, map locations on disk with files. And then you've got lots of different ways that you might access the files. And these file system structures need to be optimized for all of the various ways that the files might get accessed. So people might want to do a search, or they might want to follow a path to get to a particular file.
And these files are stored as little bits and pieces in different locations in the operating system. And the file system string these bits and pieces together in order so that you get your file back the way you wanted it. Mm-hmm. And in the early days, we had this concept of fragmentation where more and more of the files got scattered more and more instead of being contiguous. Is that something that modern users have to worry about, fragmentation?
Not really, especially not on SSDs where the seek time is you know, not, it's pretty much negligible. It becomes an issue on a backup disk, for example, when you really get down to that last, you know, 10 to 15% of the disk. And when you're getting into there, really, it's mostly in much smaller percentages. You get down to the last gigabyte, and that last little bit of free space is probably highly fragmented, and it just gets harder for the file system to figure out where to put stuff. So it takes longer to copy stuff into that last gigabyte. But for the most part, you know, if you've got 15% overhead or more, you're not going to notice the effects of fragmentation.
Cool. Well, one of the things we know about APFS from WWDC is this new feature called Snapshot. I'm familiar with that from using an app called Parallels Desktop, which allows you to build virtual machines and snapshot them so that you can go back in time. So now we're going to get that in macOS Sierra when APFS ships.
It's actually only a developer preview in Sierra, and that's an important thing for
people to know about. Yeah, we'll get Sierra first. We'll get Sierra first with HFS Plus, as I understand it, and maybe October. Yeah. And then next year, we'll get APFS installed in a version of maybe Sierra at some point, or maybe a kit that allows us to do an upgrade. I think at WWDC they mentioned that there was going to be a migration tool.
Yeah, they weren't real clear on when exactly APFS would be available, but I would anticipate it being available in the next major operating system. But they did say 2017.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Somebody also said 2017 is right around the corner.
Maybe they meant and October 17 when Mac OS Mojave comes out.
Yeah, exactly.
Or whatever.
I would certainly...
I'm not making any announcements here. I'm just guessing.
I would hope so. I mean, file systems are really complex and take many years to develop. And I don't know that this one has been under development for terribly long.
Just about 3 years, as far as I know.
Yeah, that's the impression that I got. So, you know, especially having just gotten our hands on the developer preview, you know, as a third-party developer, we'd certainly like to see at least a year to play around with it and get a feel for it. You know, we're certainly taking a look at it. And we've been anticipating the snapshot functionality for years. Obviously, snapshots can play an important role in a backup strategy. And that's something that, you know, would certainly be nice to be able to leverage.
We were talking before the show about how a snapshot is not the same as a Time Machine backup.
Yeah, well, it's what I said is snapshot's not backup. It's those aren't interchangeable terms. And if you have a snapshot, you know, you have a second copy of a file, but you don't necessarily have a backup. And the important thing to understand is that snapshots occur on the source. So let's suppose you next major OS comes out, you migrate to APFS, and now you've got your operating, your startup disk on an APFS volume. When you create a snapshot, you're creating a snapshot on your startup disk. And what happens from there forward is that all of the files that you've written to prior to the snapshot, they're basically read-only. Any attempts to write to them writes to new blocks on the disk. So if you, you know, create a snapshot right before an OS update, which I think would be a really good idea to do regularly, you don't have a backup. If that disk fails, everything is gone, snapshot or not. So
right. And more to the point, if you do a snapshot, and then, as I understand it, if you create a new file like my diary entry, and something goes wrong, and you do a revert to the previous snapshot, all those new files are gone.
They're not actually.
Actually,
if you create a snapshot right before you go back to the previous snapshot.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. But if you leave a snapshot dormant for months, then you risk losing the files that you've created since the snapshot. Is that right?
Well, I don't know. We don't know. That's certainly a possibility, and we don't know where specifically Apple's going to go with this. We certainly get some hints with the storage management or storage optimization functionality that Apple announced in Sierra. You'll notice in Disk Utility, there's this new purgeable space indicator. And I would anticipate that if Apple has this option to automatically delete trash that's older than 30 days, that they would eventually, once APFS is in production, they would have a similar functionality where, you know, snapshots older than 30 days would get thrown into that purgeable space category. That would be my guess. I'm just speculating here.
Do you think it's possible, or do you think Apple would like to create us like a Time Machine 2.0 that acts like the old Time Machine, but really has a completely different structure underneath?
Well, I would like to claim a little vindication here, first of all.
Okay.
Apple introduced directory hard links for Time Machine. They did that back on, I think, 10.5. And directory hard links were, you know, they told us, third parties shouldn't touch these. These are dangerous devices. You could create recursive directory entries, and they're just really tricky to work with, so don't use them. And basically, Apple's Time Machine was the only thing that used it. And I never implemented support for directory hard links because I felt the only thing you'd need it for was copying a Time Machine volume, which you can do in the Finder. So, lo and behold, I think Apple is probably a little fed up with directory hard links itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always been a criticism of Time Machine.
Yeah, and it's kind of a hack solution. You know, given the limitations of HFS, it was a good interim solution. Given how short amount of time that they've been working on APFS, though, I'm surprised that they hadn't been working on a solution to that sooner. But you never really know what's going on at Apple.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, snapshot management, I think, is going to be a really important thing coming up with APFS.
You think it's something that Apple might just automatically do in the background, you know, like every night at midnight or something?
I don't know about that. But I think that when space gets critically low, you know, they're gonna, I think there's something called delete D in OS X that's constantly looking at things that it could delete, and cache files, temporary files. Those are already on the chopping block nowadays. With Sierra, the trash is now on the chopping block. And even your desktop and photos, if I'm not mistaken, are potentially up for removal from the local volume if you've got that iCloud syncing going on. So I think that they're looking at folks who have dwindling space on their disk, and they're trying to figure out how they can optimize that storage.
That's something we'll want to talk about at the Mac Observer to make sure our readers understand the dangers and the advantages of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because suddenly finding your file is not there anymore, and you have to munge around and discover that it's been moved to the cloud. That could be alarming to some people.
Yeah, especially if it's a file on your desktop or your photo collection.
Right, right.
Just your important stuff.
Well, we're just about out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to squeeze in?
I think I'd mentioned we just hired a new developer, and you know, our company has grown a little bit. We're at 7 people, and we are happily growing. We just hired a new developer, Peter. We'll get his picture on the website soon. But he's been great. You know, he's been working on some new functionality. We're always looking forward, and we're always working on the next major version of CCC.
Are you tantalized by the idea of a subscription model?
Please say what?
Of a subscription model?
Oh, no.
No, no. Good, good.
You know, we certainly have looked at pricing and, you know, how you structure it. It's a complicated subject because from a consumer perspective, you know, you want to buy a product and you expect to be able to use it for a really long time without having to pay every year. And I totally agree with that and would not intend to do something other than that, just to be very clear about that.
Given the model that you have, I assume you're thriving and growing and doing well then.
Yes, we are doing well.
Cool.
But then on the other hand, you know, to look at it from the developer perspective, you know, if you have a 2 or 3 year release cycle and you've got these big major upgrades and, you know, you want people to pay for them, it means you're kind of holding back on functionality. I would love to have just, you know, I got a new feature, took me 2 months to make it, bam, there you go, have fun. All of my existing users start using it right away. That would be great. But we can't really do that. You know, we got to hold back the functionality that you're working on and push out larger updates over longer periods of time, which, you know, I don't like it as much. Like I said right at the beginning, you know, you spend 5 minutes doing something, you create it, it does something really cool. I want to share it immediately with everybody. You know, I've got several features that I've developed already for the next major version of CCC. Some of them are really cool. I have to sit here and not talk about them, say anything about them.
It's okay, because you've got thousands of loyal fans who've been saved by your software and love what you do and are so thankful for you. We all appreciate your product and what you do and your devotion. I mean, it's one of those stellar apps that it was top 10 list. You know, you just make a list of apps you just have to have. This is it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to have to close it out and finish up. So I want to thank you very much for being on the show with me. This has been delightful and pleasantly technical. I always wanted to hear just some of those cool technical details and hear about your past and how you came to create this remarkable and wonderful product. So thanks again for joining me.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Sure. You can reach us with general questions at info@bombic.com. Or if you have a highly technical question that you'd like to ask me directly, you're certainly welcome to email me at mike@bombic.com.
Excellent. Excellent. Folks, we're glad you just came by. I appreciate you listening in. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.